Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, and welcome to the K-Thompson Live Show. My name is Eric Payne. I am the son, and you are?
I'm the mother. I'm Kay Thompson. And how are you, Eric Payne?
Fine, thanks, Mike.
Well, you know what we started with? We started with James Brown, the big payback. That seems to be, you know, the proper music to start with, the big payback. And I'm thinking of the situation in Ferguson, with the killing of young Michael Brown and all that has been going on. So that has to be payback. And the payback has to be with people voting and people coming out and being counted. And as a matter of fact, protest is going on all around the country. And I'm so glad to see that, because the fact that this was something that is long overdue, the problems with the African-American community, the Latino community, with the different police departments around the country has been absolutely incredible and really, really very serious, serious stuff, and nothing has been done about it. So it's about time that things start happening, but we hope to have it done in a positive way. You know, in fact, there are angry protesters protesting all around the country. There's people in New York, there's people in Boston, Roxbury, down in Atlanta. Over 21 people were arrested down here in Atlanta alone. In Los Angeles, dozens on Friday, and in Portland. So a lot of things going on that's really, really negative. So we thought it was appropriate that we put on James Brown with the big payback. As a matter of fact, so part of his documentary, which was so effective. But, you know, let's stay with Ferguson for a little while.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Ferguson. We'll get to James Brown next week for another episode. But the payback is apropos.
Yeah.
That's why we decided to play it tonight. There's a lot of negative stuff going on, but there's also a lot of positive things going on across the country as well. A lot of people are standing up. A lot of people are protesting. And it's not just one ethnic group. As I look on the news and see, I see a lot of white Americans, Caucasian Americans, mm-hmm. There are all kinds of Americans that are standing up and standing up when there's an injustice. And in this particular case, there was an injustice, because after hearing the prosecutor talk about what was going on with the case, and he really never got to what in fact caused this man to shoot this young man, this officer to shoot this young man 12 times, put 12 bullets in his body. And we have a caller, your mic is open. We have a caller right now on the phone. Is that you, Congressman Payne?
Yes,
good
evening, Congressman Payne. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. Do you have a comment about Ferguson?
Jump right in there.
Disappointed and disgusted in the outcome of the grand jury's investigation. As we know, the prosecutor in this case abdicated his job and just allowed a dumping of the information in this case to lay in the lap grand jury without any type of direction. And that's not normally how a prosecutor functions. And, it is just a travesty of justice. This young man, who will never be with us again, has not had the opportunity to really have this looked at in an objective manner.
You're right about that. Congressman, I just want to take a minute and welcome our other guest host, Mr. I think, is that you, Mr. Gilman? Do we have you on the line, Mr. Wayne Gilman?
That's correct there, Mr. Eric. How are you?
How are you today? I'm fine, sir. And I see that we had a caller on the 908 number. Caller, you can call back if you like and make your comments known. Wayne, what would you like to say? You heard the congressman talk about, the grand jury not doing their job, but really the prosecutor. What are your thoughts about that?
I'd have to agree. Good evening, Congressman Payne. I tell you, it's unfortunate what has happened. I really don't know where to begin because there's so many facets to what's happened in the last 72 hours. I am highly offended by the Giuliani appearance on Meet the Press as it pertains to this particular case. That's one aspect of it. It sickened me that they knew full well what was going down. And when they announced this, made this announcement on Monday evening at 9 o'clock, why did you wait so late and so long for that to happen? It was already preconceived that, just the orchestration, the way the media played it, because it was like as if this was all part of a plan. And the congressman is absolutely right, and it's been proven over the number of years and I guess historical and empirical information has been provided to the networks about how easy it is to bring an indictment in a case like this. But the one thing that just bothers me, and I was talking to Kay about this earlier today, is that there is a symbiotic relationship between, the prosecutor's office, the police department, the upper echelons of law enforcement, and it goes directly right up to the White House, for that matter, And it sickens me that we have to come out and do the nonsense that we do, but it just seems that, and I'm not one to condone violence and tearing up police cars or even the homes that I live in. But the fact of the matter is that nonsense that used to go on back in the 60s that and coupled with the civil rights movement and demonstrating on a regular basis is what led to social programs in this country that led to changes that gave me an opportunity to go to school, gave you an opportunity to go to college. All those things happened not because we peacefully demonstrated, it's because white folks were afraid of what we could do after seeing what we did in our neighborhoods in Bedford Stuyvesant and Newark and Harlem and South Central Los Angeles, all those places. And it just sickens me that 40 years later we're still going through the same crap.
But Wayne, this is something that has been, festering for a long period of time. I knew some years ago that something like this was going to happen because it just was building up and building up and nothing was being done about it. I remember early in the 60s, what was happening with the police department in New York, and then the jails were filling up with young black men being arrested for things that they shouldn't have been arrested for, given all these long sentences. And now we have the jails that are overcrowded with young blacks and for menial things at times.
Right.
I'm not saying that some of them shouldn't be there, but certainly not in the numbers that's there now. And it's just unfair. So something like this has been brewing. I can't say that I'm surprised about it. I'm just surprised that, a young man had to lose his life, for this to get started. And I'm so glad to see this is the kind of thing that's really bringing the people together, the different races together.
And Congressman, let's get the Congressman back in. Congressman, let me ask you, from a legislative and an establishment standpoint, for lack of a better term, what are the type of things that you as an elected official, and I know that the Congressional Black Caucus put out a scathing statement on the decision made by the prosecutor, the grand jury, but what establishment type of things that do you guys see that might be possible that you can do from a legislative standpoint?
Well, basically, we've been in contact with Mr. Holder, and have had several conversations with him in reference to the investigation that is ongoing by the federal government, that they be due diligent, and where the authorities in the state of Missouri could not find the backbone to do the right thing, that he stay the course and maintain vigorous investigation into this circumstance. We at the Congressional Black Caucus are dismayed by the outcome of this. But in sitting there the other night and watching in the news accounts and waiting for the prosecutor to come out and make his statement, I sat there and thought that, well, if there was a reason to indict, or they were going to indict, it would have been a 3 or 4 minute statement, and then you would say that there was an indictment found, by the grand jury. But being that, the news account said that the prosecutor would come out and there would be a statement and then he would ask questions, brought me pause. And then to sit there and listen to his explanation or justification to where we found that the grand jury was not going to indict, as we got 6 minutes into it, 7, 8, 10, 12, 13, and 14 minutes into it, I knew that they weren't going to indict because he was laying out a case of justifying why the decision had been rendered that way. And it just really, I was listening to a defense attorney more than I was listening to a prosecutor. And it's really disgusting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that I knew that it wasn't going to, the fix was in from the very beginning when this gentleman wouldn't recuse himself. And he has such a close relationship, family of police officers and things like that. And how long they were taking to release any information, as if they wanted to get their story together. And as if they also talk about the officer putting his own weapon in evidence, washing his hands, doing all these things that seem somewhat suspect to me, that they would try to get their story together and put all their ducks in a row. And I knew from the very beginning that they were never going to indict, being that this individual was there to make sure that wasn't going to happen. And when that's all I want to say for now. I want to get the caller. We have a new caller on the line here. I want to get you on this discussion. Go on, caller at 405-908-405, first three numbers. Go ahead.
Good evening. How are you?
All right. How are you tonight?
All right.
You're
wonderful. First of all, I'm calling from Plainfield, New Jersey, and I'm going to blow your minds because this is Kiyoshi.
Hey, Kiyoshi, how you doing?
Hey, my brother, how are you? First
all right.
Of all, I love you guys. I just want to say hello. I wish my mother could say hello. I don't want to go into that right now, but I have no words to speak of the events of this entire year. And I can almost equate it to what they called the Red Summer several decades ago, from the era of the late 1800s into the 1920s, when, although this is happening on a smaller scale, but when white supremacists and racists attacked our communities and basically sought to destroy them.
Yeah.
Of course, at this time, it seems as if they're doing it one at a time. And they're creating a dialogue wherein certain image or a certain type fits a narrative. And this is the painting that they're presenting to the world. And I'm hearing echoes from the world looking upon this nation, this country, that people fought and died for, as hypocrites to this myth that they've built for the last Lord knows how long.
Yeah.
I went down to Newark the other day when they were having several different demonstrations. The earlier one was rather sparse. Unfortunately, I didn't get to go to the evening one, but I'd be waiting for the one, any more that's coming up, so I'll be keeping my ears to the grindstone then. Basically,
right,
folks, that's pretty much all I have to say.
Yeah, along those lines, you were saying, Kiyoshi, and it's good to talk to you a long time, and I'm sure the Congress will remember Kiyoshi Matsumoto. And,
that's right, my brother.
And, you know, this has been something, like you said, that's been coming for a long time. But here, in this particular situation, they framed the argument. They prepared everybody for a negative outcome. When the governor, in my estimation, when the governor of the state, Nixon, who never came out or barely came out when it first happened, as did the mayor of Ferguson, and then they come out and say, we're going to have the National Guard this time because we don't want any violence and people act a certain way. Well, when you do that, you kind of you're putting the onus on the demonstrators, the people who have a rightful rightful feeling, a right to be mad, a right to be upset.
Exactly.
But when you
right.
present a precursor, a pre-context for actions, and say
right.
we're going to have the National Guard because people are going to be upset,
well,
you're framing the thing as if the protesters are now wrong.
Yeah.
And that's what they've been doing all along.
Well,
how they disparage the character of Mike Brown and how they tried to tie the events of what he did at the convenience store with as if Officer Wilson, you remember, they first tried to suggest that Officer Wilson was following up on that little crime that he had committed when it turned out he knew nothing of that. So when they frame the argument and create the narrative, kind of like what we did in my other business, the show business, they create the narrative, create the storyline, and then they have everything fit the storyline, and they prepare the psyche of the public to receive that. So when it happens the way they want it to happen, nobody's really surprised. They get upset. But what they're hoping is that people would die down and people would lose their momentum. But what they weren't counting on is that this young black boy will be shot in Ohio just the same week of the verdict. So,
but one thing they didn't count on, and they didn't count on the fact that the attention of this particular case would go so far. It is going all around the country, and it's going into different countries. So I don't think that they really expected this kind of, notoriety, but this kind of story.
Right. I'll be in touch with you guys. I just connected to you, Kay, on Facebook. So respond
we'll
to
talk,
that. And
we'll talk again
definitely
very
want
soon.
To talk to you more. I have a lot to tell you, but I don't want to take up your show doing that.
Guys,
just keep up the good work. I'll be listening in. There's a lot to say and a lot to do.
All right.
Peace.
Thank you.
Peace. All right, man. Love you.
Take care. Love you, too. So I just wanted to talk about it, and Wayne and Congressman, you chime in here. And Kiyoshi is someone that we've known from childhood.
Yeah.
And we've all grown up. So, you know, we would all be remiss, at least the three of us in our generation, would be remiss. I'm talking about Congressman Kiyoshi and myself. Would be remiss if we grew up with a mentality where we ended up hating all white people.
Right.
And as we grew to be men and we left those high school and junior high areas where we realized the distinction of the races in America and that our walk was different than our white friends' walk, but we still have those Caucasian, those white people that are very good friends of ours that we grew up with, that we consider like brothers. And so it would be... even though my emotion sometimes is very hateful and I want to take the easy road and be mad at all white people, I can't in good conscience be that way. And I don't think any of us can that grew up with individuals that would fight for us like a lot of the individuals that are marching out there now. Those Caucasian people are not the ones we need to worry about. We need to have the ones who might be in the middle who think that when we bring up these issues, they kind of take it personal. They kind of take it as if you're attacking the entire white race and them being white. They feel like, well, I didn't do that. I didn't put your people in slavery and bondage. I didn't do that. Of course you didn't, but you must realize that you are the beneficiary of those very actions.
Exactly.
And the fact that they don't trickle down to you now is not the fault of the people that are just getting their rights. That's the fault of the capitalist system that keeps the poorer people down and the wealthier people up. So I just want to know, I just want to throw that out there and find out what all of you guys have to think about that.
Wayne, Congressman, what is
Well, I just want to say that I happen to agree. I think that there are a number of well-intended, progressive whites out there that clearly understand exactly what is going on. And it's not just, you know, what is happening here in the States. This particular story has resonated with everyone around the world. I happened to be watching French TV last night, and there was a formal news discussion for the better part of an hour by a French television newscaster who was interviewing a number of people from the States, but from Paris. And everyone chimed in pretty much on the same playing field with respect to the deficiency of the prosecutor's office in Missouri, and the fact that, you know, this behavior has gone on not just in Ferguson but other parts of the country. It's become an American phenomenon. And the thing is that, you know, I'm a little older than you are, Eric, and I mean I'm not as old as a lot of people who were out there during the height of the civil rights movement when it began in the 1950s. But the thing is that I lived through, you know, all the protest activity. I grew up, I'm a product of the late 1960s and 70s, and I saw what was going on, and I saw what progress we made as a people, maybe too young at the time to really appreciate it, but as I became a young adult, you know, I saw what progress in terms of social programming, what it did in terms of improving relationships between blacks and whites in this country. The South specifically, I'm not saying there aren't pockets of racism and conservative and right-wing elements that right-wing elements that don't exist there, and you certainly have a contingency of redneck folk that live in certain pockets of the South, but, you know, the South isn't what it used to be. You know, there's a lot of blue in all those red states that still exist. But the fact of the matter is that we are dealing with, there is something that requires a certain amount of behavior modification when it comes to dealing with the police department and black men or black youth or people of color. Yeah. Specifically, that's what angers me the most, because after all this progress, we're still dealing with issues like this. And then, just to kick it in a different direction, as I said at the outset of the program, I'm highly offended that we had a mayor here who wanted a third term. He goes around the country promoting himself as America's mayor, and he led to more polarization and dissension. Yes, exactly. Rudolph Giuliani needs to have his damn head examined. You know, for him to get on the tube and engage in discourse with one of our leading educators in this country and blame the black-on-black violence that exists in all of urban America on the fact that it's important that we have white cops to oversee how we... You know, what it is that we do. I just think I'm amazed that they allowed that to even be on the air for an hour.
Yeah, we knew about Joe Giuliani, you know, years ago, you know, when we were on Wayne, you know. But I want to ask the Congressman Donald Payne Jr., listen, what can be done in Congress, if anything, regarding this whole episode?
Well,
are you there?
I mean, you know, I'm here. From the federal level, we need to continue to engage the administration. We are the legislative branch of the government. The purview for quite a bit of this falls under the executive branch, but we do have a legislative opportunity to craft some type of legislation towards civil rights issues that can reach into some of these states. But you have to understand, you have to remember, our reach can only be so far. States' rights is still a very important part of this nation's model or creed. And so it gets a little difficult sometimes on the federal level to craft things that we can get the states to adhere to. So we have to be deliberate and diligent and take our time in crafting it where it will have the impact that we want it to have. You know, there's creating and passing legislation, and then, you know, the most difficult part is the enforcement. So
yeah.
we can create laws, but if there are going to be laws that we create that we cannot get people to enforce and adhere to, then it's all for naught. I think that we need to just continue to use the bully pulpit and this opportunity now to continue to look for like-minded individuals, black, white, Hispanic, or whoever, who says this has to stop. There was someone mentioned on my Facebook page, we talked about voting, and someone said voting doesn't matter. But you see, it may not be the total answer, but it's part of the answer. Because if you had people in these communities that are engaged in choosing who their leadership is, you know, the council wouldn't be majority non-African American in a majority African American town. That goes to your individual right to vote, to choose your leaders, who if you had a mayor who was sensitive to these issues, then maybe the police chief would be black, and there would be more than two black police officers in the town. It makes no sense. So voting is not the total answer, but you have to choose your representation. You're in the position that you're in now because you don't exercise your rights, period.
It's a large part of it. That's why we have to always constantly tell people that, listen, you have to know what's going on politically. You have the people with the power. You have to get out and vote and find out what the issues are. And then if you disagree with something, then you go and you vote for your person that's going to get it to, you know, deal with those issues. And it's so important.
That's right.
Absolutely.
If you don't care to vote, then you're going to get leadership that doesn't care about you.
That's right.
And also, really, along those lines as well, I mean, too many people died for the right to vote. So even if people don't believe it's going to do anything, do your responsibility, pay your homage to the ancestors and the people that came before you so you can vote today. And, you know, I understand the frustration of that, but we have to do our part. And I also think that, and I might have discussed this with you before, Congressman, and I know that I discussed with some other people that our generation really kind of had it a little bit easier, that our parents were the civil rights generation. And we really, at times when I think about it, perhaps weren't as aggressively active in pushing the agenda and the plight of our people forward. And just to stay on it, in terms of a continuing pushing forward for the rights of our people and to expand on those rights and make sure that we are able to realize the full American dream that is allegedly supposed to be available to everybody.
To be honest, I mean, we might as well be blunt. A lot of our generation was spoiled. We came up with parents and grandparents that fought, struggled, and died, and they made sure that we had everything they didn't have, and everybody took a breath. Everybody had
that's
care.
True.
We were comfortable. We had made it. We were in the suburbs. We were going to the better schools. So we had arrived. But we have to always continue to remember that there's someone that is not in the position that you're in. And so the struggle continues. Yes, I mean, and that's That is my motto. That is my creed. I always know that there before the grace of God go I. We have people that are still in circumstances and conditions that are not in the ones that we were raised and were reared in. And so we always have that obligation to reach back and make sure that we're bringing someone along with us. And then know that the struggle is not done. I think, with the election of President Obama, it has been the tale of two cities. It's the best of times, and it's the worst of times. It is an opportunity to see that the system that was created in this country can work. It may be just this one time, but it does work because we were able to elect someone that captured the imagination of this nation who looked like us.
Absolutely.
So the system does work. But it has allowed this country to rear every ugly epitaph, every ugly scenario that it ever had go on in this country at the same time. It is the tale of two cities, and it is unfortunate that in such a great time in the nation's history, it is rearing its ugly head as some of the worst times that it ever showed.
I have to say this too, the congressman, that I'm really amazed and surprised and pleased at the number of women's organizations now, the sororities. The different women's organizations that are becoming quite powerful, and a lot of them, I'm not even going to attempt to name them all, the organizations and the political people. I'm very, very pleased with them, and we're going to be having some of those key political people from the metropolitan area on the show in coming days and, coming shows. So I have to give the props. And the credit to a lot of my sisters out there who are really working very, very hard and supporting the political postures that some of the politicians are making for the good of the community.
And also, from what you were saying along the lines of us being spoiled, we were. And also, what created was the Jack and Jill black people. And it's the un-Jack and Jill black people. And we know what that meant because a lot of times we kind of resented that kind of Jack and Jill vibe, which was the bougie, what we used to call bougie black people getting together, all together just so their kids could socialize with each other and grow up with other kids, African-American kids, who had similar values, and which is something that is hard to find when you have African-American kids from a more urban setting, a more poorer setting. So, but in that, what created was a disunity of those of us that had the fortune of coming from middle-class backgrounds. Some of us forget, as you said, Congressman, that we need to reach back and we need to identify with some of our members of our race that, bottom line, live in the hood. Some of us that grew up in the suburbs don't want to be what's, quote, the hood. I don't want to call it the hood because it's the old neighborhood. But some of us don't want to be around, And one of the things about you and your father, and my father as well, and other, a lot of leaders in areas, that they were able to have the respect of being what they called a regular people, a regular guy. And so many times I meet people that find out the congressman, late congressman, was my uncle. And one of the biggest compliments they could say, what I see that someone could say about elected officials, that person's a regular guy, meaning that they don't put on airs. When you see them, mm-hmm. they talk to you. When you see them, they look you in the eye and talk to the average citizen like they're the person they are. And they don't look past them. They don't act like they're less than. But they let the person know that they're there for them. And that certainly, my mom and a lot of other people that raised us to be those type of people. And that goes a long way. That goes a very long way.
In terms of the organizations such as Jack and Jill and all, I don't think I ever had a resentment for them.
We were never a part of that, but that's okay, because you know, as you say, well, I still live in the hood because I live on the same street that I was raised on, and I'm raising my children right in the center of the South Ward of Newark, New Jersey. But it never was a resentment. But I think the growth and the spurning of those organizations came out of the areas that these people had moved to and aspired to and become accomplished and were able to buy nicer, more beautiful homes in different communities, that they weren't accepted in those communities. So they had to come together to bring their children together for, you know, where they weren't accepted once again in those communities. So I think it was a networking of families that had gotten to a certain level but still did not have that interaction for their children in that community that was desired. So I think those organizations grow out of that. Now, it does cause a schism, because then there are people that don't become part of those organizations. But, you know, it's the reason that historically black colleges were created. You couldn't get into the other schools, so you had to create your own.
Congressman, exactly. If I might, I'm glad that you brought that up. I grew in the shadow of the Jack and Jill organization, the Lynx, the Comas, in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, when Bedford-Stuyvesant was considered a ghetto. Now I can't even afford to live back there. The thing is that bothered me in, you know, the period that I grew up in, is that there was a certain internal racism factor that almost as if we were in a caste system. You know, if you didn't pass the brown paper bag litmus test for inclusion, you weren't a part of that. If your parents spoke a different language or they had a West Indian accent, there was a problem with that too. And I think that the one thing that bothered me, because at least my parents taught me that in spite of what was going on at that time, that I couldn't be a participant, my parents came here as poor immigrants, at least they showed all of us that there can be a better way. And I think as time went on, even people within those organizations realized that they had to change the mission statements, you know, the bylaws, to widen the circle so that if you were darker than the brown paper bag, there was some inclusion, and there was something to feel a certain amount of personal pride and self esteem, and that's the thing that used to bother me about the Comas, the Lynx, the Jack and Jill particularly, you know, because it just seemed to be part of that phenomenon at that particular time. But it took a movement to make the changes, and I'm glad to see that you're still in the area, and you know, Eric said some things about your dad, and, you know, in the years that I used to cover him, he was a class act, you know. We had the Charlie Wrangles and the Shirley Chisholms on this side of the river, but your dad, you know, had every reason to make anyone who lived in New Jersey proud.
Listen,
thank you. I appreciate that.
I remember when Shirley Chisholm came to our house in Maplewood, okay? And she was living in Brooklyn at that time. And it was really quite an experience. And those of us who were in sororities, and I was one, we were very politically active, okay, because of the fact that we were confronted with all that different racism, okay? So you can't really, you know, not the women's organizations or, you know, the sororities and the Jack and Jills, et cetera, because there were people in these organizations that were always fighting, you know, for what was right in the communities, because you got sick and tired of that stuff. You know, so some of these women really led the way. Like I'm talking about Wynonna Lippman, versus I think she was the first senator in New Jersey or something, black woman, you know, state senator, and a number of other people. So there were those who were fighting, you know, for, you know, what was right, still fighting for what was right. Now I'm still doing a radio show. Years ago, went to WIB and got again involved politically. Some of the issues of WIB were brought out because of Black radio. And people should really be appreciative of that fact that it wasn't all music. The music
right.
was good on the BOS side, but WIB was a talk show, and we were bringing up a lot of political, solid political issues.
Right, and no one is saying, since I brought it up, I'm not saying anything anti-against those organizations for middle-class African-Americans and people that foster the support group. It's just that in that schism that was created, it left people a little disjointed in terms of of a unifying factor for the entire race. And that's what we really, in my estimation, need to focus on, particularly nowadays when we saw not only the killings of African-American men, which seem to either were paying more attention since we have a Black president, or they seem to have spiked a little bit since we had a Black president. But we need to unify along across those class barriers as well. I mean, some of us do that, but some of us don't do that. So that's kind of the direction we need to go in. You know, as I think, and I think, Congressman, if you might want to call back, maybe your call is dropped or maybe you had another event. But I think that we need to come together and unify for the sake of our people, but also we need to be have think tanks and really, I know that we already have, but really think about a course of action. Because what happens in these scenarios with the killing of young Black youth, there are no consequences for these people.
Mm-hmm.
There's no consequence for these police officers that do it randomly, that do it with the abandon, almost, it seems like. And when you have no consequence to your action, then you're just going to continue. You're going to continue to follow suit in those actions. We're not saying that every police shooting. I mean, I was able to see the tape of the young 12-year-old boy that was shot, Tamir Rice. And as they show the videotape, the cop hops out the car and shoots him. But when you see the videotape, you see the kid playing with what appears to be what was a toy gun, with the yellow, with the orange cap taken off. So he's pointing it around as he's walking around the playground. So he's walking up as the cop car pulls up, and I couldn't see the tape clearly, but it looked as if he had that gun in his hand as the cop pulled up out the car and kind of shot him and shot him immediately, pretty much. But it looked as if the cops pulled up as he was walking in that pull up in front of him. So if he was playing with the gun he had in his hand, so the cop immediately hopped out the car and shot him. There might be the unfortunate mistake of taking the child's life because of that there. But because of what we see in other cases, we can't it makes us hard to have a balanced, an open mind about that particular police-involved shooting. That might have been justified. It might have been a terrible mistake. But how are we to believe that when we just came out of this debacle that happened in Ferguson, when the prosecutor clearly presents, and some of the questions are coming out. I didn't get a chance to read read all of the information, but I'm watching some of the shows and seeing that the prosecutors were basically asking leading questions of Officer Wilson, and some of the things that they didn't present. Like, how does the guy, I mean, George Stephanopoulos asked a harder question, saying he was 35 feet away. At what point are you afraid of your life when someone's 40 feet away from you? First off.
That's a very good point, Eric, because, I mean, there was so much misinformation about what was actually being presented to the grand jury that, you know, you didn't know what to believe. And I think that's where, you know, between the misinformation and the facts, basically – there's got to be some validity, some truth in all of that. And the bottom line is that I just think it's a larger issue. We just had a situation here in Brooklyn a week ago where a poor kid was bringing his girlfriend home, and instead of waiting for an elevator in a housing project, he chose, regrettably, to take a back staircase that was dimly lit. And you put two rookies who just got out of school to patrol one of the most dangerous neighborhoods in the city, and kaboom, you know, we have a trigger happy cop who's probably you know, there wasn't someone more seasoned to even if there was a fear factor there, there would have been a situation where somebody of sound mind would have anesthetized the problem. Your mom, Kay, she years ago we used to interview this Muslim brother, Humza El Hafiz, whose real name is Lenny Ware. He was he worked directly under Minister Louis Farrakhan and Elijah Muhammad, but he was a New York City cop, a decorated cop. He worked in some of the worst neighborhoods in Brooklyn and in Manhattan, Harlem specifically. But the one thing, when he testified before the Knapp Commission in the 1970s about the corruption going on in the police department here in New York, the one thing that he was cited for, that he never had to pull his gun in areas that were highly crime-ridden at that particular time. And I think there's something to be said about that.
Yeah. Well, and there's another thing. Do you remember The Guardian? You know,
the Guardian's also.
In New York, you know, and that was headed by Dr. Ali al-Rahman.
Right.
And those guys got together. They were a group of black police persons, and they came on LIB because I had given them some time, you know, on, you know, my particular show. And they were dealing with problems in the community because a lot of the people from the community couldn't go to the different police departments because of the fact that there was intense racism going on, and they were afraid of the police. So this group of policemen, the boys and women, you know, were really very powerful. They were very powerful in Harlem and in Brooklyn and, you know, Queens, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, they were absolutely excellent.
My issue, and I see we have the congressman back. So, congressman, I'm going to open your mic because I want you to get in on this subject I'm going to bring. But I'm convinced that it's about training and that we don't make being a peace officer one of the last jobs you get or that people get when they get out of high school and they have no vocation, they got no plans to go to college, do anything else, so they'll take whatever test they can take and become a cop. It's kind of like people joining the service, too. So I'm convinced that we need to pay these like teachers, we need to pay the peace officers, the people that are paid to protect and serve our communities, we need to pay them a little bit more, and we also need to demand more training.
Yeah,
they need to have a degree. And it'll give them kind of the wisdom to think a little bit more and act mechanically less. And, Congressman, I want to get you in on this discussion, this particular point, because I know when you were the president of the city council, you were very supportive of law enforcement and officers, and you have a good relationship with them to this day in terms of getting them, helping them to get what they deserve. But how do you feel in terms of better training, making it a job that's really something that's honored and respected? It is already to a certain degree, but make it really something that it is your privilege to become a peace officer to take care of the community. How do you feel about something along those lines, Congressman Payne?
Well, I definitely think anytime you raise the compensation level of an occupation, you get a higher quality of individual. It is, and I definitely believe that teachers should be paid more based on the occupation and the outcomes we need based on their tutelage to young people. So I agree that, that they should be compensated at a certain level. And, through collective bargaining, most police organizations do very well, actually. They are compensated pretty decently, firefighters as well. But I think I agree. It goes back to training, goes back to, people being from that community, involved in those communities. And, the number of African-Americans that are taking these tests are diminishing. Whites and Hispanics are, getting these opportunities at twice the level of African-Americans. And even in Newark, we had
talked about potentially, you know, as we prepare young people in the arts and prepare young people in the sciences, started looking at potentially having programs where we prepare young people for law enforcement and the fire services. So
right.
we had a program we started with the fire department called it. Well, the fire department had one, and we started one with the police department called the Explorers. So now it's young people that are mentored by police officers from the Bronze Shield in the city of Newark, guiding him into law enforcement careers. So I think that has to be a focus, getting them early enough involved and interested in that area so we can have them prepared to take these tests and be successful and move up to the top of the class and be successful in becoming law enforcement individuals. The last class, I believe, that graduated in Newark had maybe 75 graduates, and less than 10% were African American, either women or males. So that's a problem, and we
right.
need to continue to work hard in order that we one, people engage long enough to be able to pass the criminal background parts of these occupations when they get to that age and keep them on the right track and find people that want to protect and serve in our community. There are a lot of great young people that want to go into these areas, but they aren't exposed to it. Their experiences with them have been negative. And, you know, let's be frank. Even prior to, you know, African-American communities. I mean, at one time, you know, the Italians were on the bottom of the rung and they had problems with the police. And before them, the Irish on the bottom of the rung, they had problems with the police. In fact, the word cop is short for copper because during the Irish times, they called them coppers because they wore copper badges. So cop, cop is a derivative from copper from when the time when Irish folks lived in communities and had issues with the police and brutality and the way they were treated. So, you know, it's a long history of, you know, where you are on the rung of the economic system in this country, how you feel about police.
I agree, Congressman. I think that's important. I also agree with, you know, that there's a definite need to elevate the standards. But I think even more importantly, no matter how high the level of education, there's got to be some sort of scrutiny of those elements that just seem to slip through the cracks and have a certain mindset when it comes to their perception of people of color and the culture, you know? I mean, over here in New York, you have to have a college degree to pick garbage on the street, you know? And I'm not minimizing the importance of having that as a criteria to pick garbage, but when you juxtapose that, given with some of the things that go on within the Uniform Police Department and some of the salaries. I mean, when you go out to Suffolk County, I think that's the highest paid police force in the country. These people are guarding the homes of superstars in the Hamptons, and I can't begin to tell you. I mean, there's so much definitive and empirical information out there about how racially segregated Long Island is. But, you know, these are the issues that we're confronted with, you know. I mean, there's something in the psyche, in that culture, that has to be broken. And I'm also, in, you know, with what Congressman Payne said earlier, I'm concerned about the symbiotic relationship between the cops and the upper echelon of law enforcement, the prosecutor's office, you know, the Supreme Court, so on and so forth. It's like there's no real objective component out there to weigh situations without feeling that there's a there's a leaning towards a certain agenda, you know, for lack of a better description. I don't know if I'm expressing myself properly.
No, you're absolutely correct. You're dead on, and I agree with you wholeheartedly.
We completely agree with that. You know, we're coming to the end of the show, but I really wanted to just mention a few things that's happening downtown Newark. And Congressman, you realize that, you know, all the new businesses, you know, things happening downtown Newark. And I did want to mention a few things that the people, you know, will enjoy. As a matter of fact, we were talking about the new restaurant downtown Newark, and that is Duke's Southern Table. And that's Vaughn's the first in the place, and she has jazz, and she is located on what street is that down there? It's off of Broad Street. It's either Clinton Street. I think it's Clinton Street. It's between Clinton Street and Broad Street, anyway. And they are featuring the John Bowers Quartet, jazz quartet down there. Let's see, I think that's tomorrow, Friday. Is today? What? Today's Wednesday. But Friday, November 28th. And then on Saturday, they're having the Lee Hogan music. As a matter of fact, Sister Houston and Dionne Warwick were down there, you know, last weekend, I understand. Also, you know, also, we should realize that there are a number of other things, you know, really going on, a lot of new businesses. Newark is becoming, when we talk about Newark, we also talk about New York together these days. We also consider the metropolitan area. So I have that those cookies, Wayne Gilman.
Well,
then we have another, you know, a new politician out there in Plainfield. You know, I think his name is Chorries, and you know, we're going to find out more about, you know, what he's doing out there in Plainfield. There's a lot of things going on. The new mayor of Newark, Ras Baraka, talked to him the other day at the Positive Community Magazine event down at New Jersey PAC, which was PAC, by the way, and they're doing quite well with all the new businesses. And so Newark and Newark, New Jersey is on the map and looking good. Of course, a lot of taxes, you know, have to be better, including the educational system and a number of other things, but everything is coming along. Eric, what do you say?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you're aware of this. If I might for a minute, I just want to say that I'm just reading on the internet that the former model and famed restaurateur B. Smith, a good friend of ours from back in the day, they just found her. She is suffering at a very young age, early Alzheimer's. And her daughter was able to, she was missing for several hours. It was a big story here. And good lady, and I'm really saddened to hear what has happened with her health, but I'm so happy to see that she was able to be found.
Thank you. Thank you, Congressman. Thank you, Wayne. We're coming to the end of the show right now. And we will join you again on Wednesday for K-Thompson Live.
Yeah. We've got a little bit of time left, just about a minute.
You're not even there.
But I want to thank you once again. I want to thank everybody for tuning in tonight. Kiyoshi Matsumoto, old high school, junior high buddy that grew up with myself and the Congressman. I want to thank Congressman Donald Payne Jr. for calling in and taking part in this discussion. Give us an insight from a legislative perspective. I want to say thank you to our host there, Wayne Gilman. Wayne.
Thank you.
Thanks, Wayne.
We didn't get a chance to get on your boy, Rudy Giuliani. I wanted to get on that, too.
Oh, please.
I don't even want to mention the man's name anymore. He's toast.
Rudy the racist, but that was, you know, that was quite a thing. But we got to go. I'm Eric Payne. Thanks for the Kay Thompson Live Show.
I'm Kay Thompson.
All right. Thanks for calling in, everybody. We'll talk to you soon.
Good night.